You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Molly Ray. On tonight's program, Liz talks with Neil Wooten about his memoir, With the Devil's Help, A True Story of Poverty, Mental Illness, and Murder. Told from two perspectives, the story alternates between Neil's life and his grandfather's, culminating in a shocking revelation. Take a journey to the Deep South and learn what it's like to be born on the wrong side of the tracks, the wrong side of the law, and the wrong side of a violent mental illness.
And I'm Sam. In the last part of the hour, Molly Ray will be speaking with Wayne Johnson about their work, Jenny's Boy, A Misfit Childhood on an Island of Eccentrics. Johnston's memoir requires a boyhood full of pain, laughter, tenderness, and the kind of wit for which Newfoundlanders are known. By that wit, and by their love for each other, so often expressed in the most unloving ways, he and they survived. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Hello, Liz, can you hear me?
Hey, how are you?
Hey, everyone.
Hey, hi, Neil, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing great. Welcome to Right On Radio. Thanks for spending a Tuesday evening with us. Neil is the author of With the Devil's Help, A True Story of Poverty, Mental Illness, and Murder, quite a bit. Let's start with your reading. Do you have one ready for us?
Yeah, I have a section ready. Are you ready?
Yep, we're ready. Go right ahead.
All right. I'm going to pull up the Word file here. I don't think it's going to affect the video. I'm not tech savvy. Okay. This is from Chapter 7, Life's a Gas, 1972. What happened? Nina asked. It had happened so fast that my older sisters were still in the dark. Dinky drank gasoline, I explained. Is she going to die? Nina asked and started crying. Nina was always the most sensitive of us. I shrugged. I didn't have an answer, but my mind instinctively played out the worst case scenarios over and over. I wondered how life would be if she didn't make it. We were all kind of fond of her, but she was not entirely one of us, at least not yet. The bond between me and my two older sisters was akin to that of the brotherly commitment of soldiers in a war. We had also been through hell and had survived, so far at least, but I wasn't sure how. I didn't know how we made it to the ages of 7, 9, and 11, or even if we'd see the next year. It seemed like we waited for hours. Maybe we did. I went to the bathroom 6 times. Finally, Mama came out to talk to us. She's going to be fine. We all breathed a sigh of relief. They had to pump her stomach, Mama continued. She'll have to stay here a little while so they can keep an eye on her. I had never experienced the euphoria that comes with news like this. A few minutes later, Daddy came out of the back. He seemed amazingly calm, or perhaps just emotionally drained. Go on back and sit with her, and I'll take the kids home. We walked out to the car, and we all got in the back seat, even though Mama and Dinky weren't in the front now. Daddy drove in complete silence. I felt sorry for him. I knew the guilt of setting the jug with the gas right beside the water jugs had to be weighing on his conscience. I thought of offering words of encouragement to lift his spirits, but I decided against it. We assumed Daddy would simply drop us off and go back to the hospital. The three of us had been staying home alone for years when Mama went with Daddy to put on dinners to sell stainless steel cookware, but Daddy followed us in. Sit down, he said, pointing to the couch. We obeyed. I wasn't sure what was coming, but I assumed it was going to be a soul-searching speech on the importance of safety, or perhaps of the bonds of family. I was wrong. Y'all almost killed your sister tonight. We all three looked at each other in confusion. Y'all know you're supposed to keep an eye on her because she's too young to look out for herself. Daddy began unfastening his belt buckle. It was a familiar scene, and what followed next was all too familiar also. Nina started crying right away. She did this at the mere possibility of a whipping, and Daddy could never bring himself to whip her with tears running down from those big brown eyes, that old softy. One thing was clear. Nina was a heck of a lot smarter than Julaine and I. Nina, go to your room. She didn't have to be told twice. It's not that she wanted to abandon us. She just didn't have the strength to disobey. Nina was devoted to our three-person band, and I have no doubt she would have taken a bullet for us. But a belt? Daddy's belt? No way. We didn't blame her at all. Julaine and I were defiant, especially when we thought Daddy was in the wrong, which he was most of the time. And this time we had zero doubt. Our goal was to show him he couldn't hurt us. Our goal was to show him we were stronger than he was. Our goal was not to cry no matter what until he realized his attempts were futile. Our goal was pure idiocy. Daddy doubled over the belt, snatched Julaine up by the left arm, and swung away. Julaine gritted her teeth, pure hatred flowing from her young face. Her eyes stayed locked on mine. My war face was on full display as well. It was my way of offering support. Daddy continued to swing as hard as he could. The sounds of the bell connecting with my sister were louder than you can imagine, and each blow chipped away at her hate and slowly replaced it with pain. As I said, Nina was much smarter. Mine and Julaine's plan had one serious flaw. Daddy did not consider the punishment successful until he saw tears. Julaine held out for an amazing amount of time, but it was not possible to go on forever. As she began to cry from the pain, Daddy tossed her back onto the couch. She stared at me, and I could read her mind. She was so sorry. She wasn't sorry for what happened to Dinky because we both knew that wasn't our fault. She was sorry because she couldn't last forever. She was sorry that she couldn't protect me because we knew it was now my turn. Daddy yanked me off the couch so hard my feet left the floor. I kept my eyes on Julaine. I wanted to make her proud. I wanted to break her record. I wanted to do everything I could do not to give that son of a you-know-what the satisfaction. I'm not sure how long I held out, but it was a personal best. When Daddy left to drive back to town, his right arm had to be hurting. We showed that bastard.
That's Neil Wooten reading from his book, With the Devil's Help, A True Story of Poverty, Mental Illness, and Murder. Briefly, generally, why don't you kind of explain what the book is about, what the overarch is of the story?
Well, it's a unique style in that it alternates between my life with my immediate family and my grandfather's life. When I was a kid growing up on Sand Mountain in the northeast corner of Alabama, we were always followed by a black car with men in black suits. And, you know, when you're a kid, you just think everything's normal. I figured every family in America had their own car with men in black suits. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what was going on. But as it even mentions in the synopsis, you know, my grandfather was convicted of murder and he was sent to Kilby Prison. This was 1963. And that was 2 years before I was born. And when my mom was pregnant with me, I guess he decided that prison life just wasn't for him. And let's say that he facilitated his own release a tad early. And we, you know, discovered that the FBI or whoever the agents were, I don't know really what department they were with, something they kind of frowned upon. And they knew my dad had helped and they knew that my dad knew where he was and that was their only lead. So They followed us. They spied on us with binoculars. And occasionally they would knock on our door, and that would always result in my dad, you know, threatening them, them threatening him. And so that was just part of my childhood. So the story interweaves between me and my brothers and sisters and mom and dad and my grandfather's life. And it all kind of comes together at the end.
And you say in the epilogue, it took you 40 years to write this book, which I can believe. It's very complex and very serious. What inspired you to wrap it up right now and get it finished and published?
You know, it wasn't really, I've written 20 books of fiction and I love nonfiction. I just never thought about having a story to write. And I think the reason is when we were growing up, there were two topics we were not allowed to talk about. And one was our home life, you know, the house we lived in, we were not allowed to have friends over, the little shack, dad was embarrassed. And the other one was my grandfather and what he had done. So, you know, just like you, things seem normal when you're a kid, the other things you learn as a kid stick with you. So I never actually thought I was allowed to tell this story. I mean, my dad's been dead for 19 years and my grandfather's been dead for 43, and I'm still expecting them to show up, you know, and be a little upset about the book. So I guess it was just that part. And plus, I really believe had I written it, I don't think I could have written it when I was younger. I think I would have been too embarrassed about it. So the timing just seemed right, I guess, to finally tell the story, because I realized that once my mom and I are gone, the story is going to be lost forever.
Let's talk about the poverty first. You say poverty, mental illness, and murder. You grew up in, I guess I would call it abject poverty, no running water, very little electricity, in a situation where having a two-seater outhouse was considered a bit of a luxury. Why don't you talk about the poverty and how it affected you as a child and perhaps even as an adult?
Well, you know, that's another thing that I thought was normal. You know, I only knew a few cousins as far as going anywhere away from home when I was little. And I knew they had that magical room in their house, you know, called a bathroom. And I remember my aunt in Fort Payne, where I live now, it's just, you know, the little town right off the edge of Sand Mountain. She had that incredible metal box in her window in her living room that put out cold air. I had never even heard of such technology, but I thought her house was unusual. I thought she was just really rich. I mean, the house is probably 800 square feet. It's a tiny, tiny house when I look at it now, but they had those things that I thought were unusual. So I thought the outhouse, you know, we never even had a well. You know, and of course, on Sand Mountain at that time, they didn't have what we called city water. That was only in the valley. So everybody had wells. And so we never even had a well dug because we never had electricity enough. So going and telling in the hollow, they had this beautiful spring down there. And it's just the best water you can imagine. And carrying the water every day, that was our chores every day, one of our chores, and carrying the water, and we used that to cook with, we used it to bathe with, and obviously we used it to drink. And that's why there were jugs sitting on the kitchen floor, and Dad had went in to clean his hands from working on the car and had actually set the gas jug right beside the water jugs, and that's how the whole scene played out that I just, how it happened, the scene I just read. So I never thought about it being different. As I've gotten older, to be honest, I realized that in some ways it was kind of a blessing. You know, it certainly makes you not want to go back to that, I guess. But I didn't know it was hard. You know, obviously a child today, say 9, 10 years old, can't even imagine living like that. And I wouldn't want them to. But I didn't know at the time it was hard, so, or even unusual for that matter. So no, I just never really thought about it as a kid. And as I've gotten older and realized how unique that was, you know, to grow up that way. Now, that obviously people in this area grew up that way in the 30s, you know, but not the 70s and 80s, you know. So But I have really don't have a lot of bad feelings about that. I think it's I think it actually kind of is advantageous in some ways, you know. I think it makes you a little tougher and more resilient. So I never thought about it when I was a kid, and I don't have any really bad thoughts about it now.
Talk about how important family is to people who are mountain born and bred.
You know, it's probably the only sure thing they have, you know, the solid rock they have in their lives to rely on. So I think that's something that's really different about rural families, because for generations, especially if they're poor, for generations, like a lot of the families were in this area, you always count on blood. And what's amazing is that even when I had relatives realizing that I was writing this book, and it took me about a year to write, which is about average for me to write a book. And when I was writing this book, I had relatives reaching out to talk about, and mainly they wanted to make sure that I knew how great a guy my grandfather and dad were. I knew my grandfather and dad better than they do, but they only knew them as these charming men, and they were charming. You know, they could tell people what they wanted to hear, but that wasn't so much the reason. It's just that this is family. Yeah, your granddad was convicted of murder, but he's a good guy, you know. And so yeah, the family bond with families that grow up this way in areas like this is really just a incredible thing in itself. So you're right.
Let's talk about the violence. It's a hard topic, I know, but let's talk about that. Do you feel like, and it goes through the book. I mean, it happens a lot to the different younger people in the book, the belt. Violence of your father and your grandfather was due to mental illness or something else, the way they
No,
were raised, perhaps.
you know, we never heard the term back then. The term, of course, was manic depressive. Now it's called bipolar, but we never heard those, so I never thought about it. But as I've gotten older and looking back, because I would say 80% of the time, my dad was very caring and very loving. I mean, he was one of those doting dads that loved to show off his kids, and he was a big hugger, you know, strictly in a parental way. He was just, you know, very loving for the most parts, but you never knew. I mean, the silliest things would just set him off, and it was just this incredible metamorphosis into this great personality, into this almost a demon. You know, his demons took over. So I don't think anybody could go from that high to that low over something as silly as a knocked over a glass of water, you know, could do that without having something wrong. And the fact that his dad, you know, Pete, my grandfather, was the same way, I have to believe that that had to be. But yeah, that was never diagnosed. That was just from my belief that that had to stem from some kind of mental illness to be able to do that. And that was daily. I mean, it was at least every day something would send him into violent episodes. And he never drank a drop, so it wasn't alcohol.
Do you think that, or was that common in the mountain, southern mountain families, or was this kind of unique?
It was more common than probably most places. I think ours was probably rougher, but when dad and his siblings, you know, seemed to be closer than he was with his kids. And I noticed that in other families back then, there were people my dad's age that were very, very close with their brothers and sisters, probably because they went through childhoods more traumatic than mine. You know, there's no telling what they, I mean, they were probably yanked out of school in first, second grade and had to work the fields. They weren't given a choice. Their parents were from the old school, let's say, and they were probably very violent parents. So the bond that develops with the siblings becomes so strong that and these same men that were just so caring with the brothers and sisters treated their kids very, very harshly. And they wound up doing, getting into that same pattern of doing what their, you know, their own father did, which is really kind of crazy. So I don't think it was that unusual that families, fathers were very, very strict and some violent. And of course, people that grew up here that had fathers that drank that were violent because of that was probably much, much worse, you know. But there were also, I would say probably the majority of people were very good parents. You know, I have a scene in the book where I talk about I was in the fourth grade in Rome, Georgia, 9 years old, and I went to stay with my coach for 3 days because my family wanted to go on vacation, which they never went on vacation, and I had an important baseball game coming up. So the coach, his son, who was in my grade and on our team, was an only child. And I mentioned how he knocked over a glass of milk one day, and I was just cringing, waiting for the inevitable. And his mom and dad laughed about it and cleaned it up. And I thought the coach was weird, you know. So it's just what you get to know as a kid. But, no, there were a lot of, I would say, poorer people in this area, kids when I was a kid, that their fathers were really rough.
You talk about your coach. In the book, you also talk about a teacher that had a great influence on you. And I, you actually say everybody has a teacher in high school that helps them out a lot. And I'm wondering if you would talk about that particular teacher and some of the things she helped you. She kind of helped you get out, I think. And talk about her.
Tony Niblett. Her husband, Terry Niblett, was the science teacher, and he was a great teacher. Tony Niblett was our math teacher, and she noticed something in me that no teacher had. And that was that I had a mathematical mind, you know, whereas I didn't realize how rare that was in the population, you know, but I got it from my dad and my granddad. They were just mathematically very, very sharp. So she recognized that right away. So right seventh, eighth grade, I was getting this, you know, direction from her that no teacher had ever bothered. I had some nice teachers, but none ever took me under their wing, so to speak. So that was a very new feeling for me. And then she put together a math team at this little school I went to, and we tried to sign up for math tournaments, and they didn't have a division for schools as small as us, but she made them put us in with the bigger schools anyway. And, you know, like it was just going to be for experience, right? But my first competition, I won 2 first-place trophies. So that's probably when I realized that coming from a small area didn't really mean anything. And it was halfway through my senior year that Miss Niblett asked me, you know, where are you going to college? And I thought she was joking. I didn't think a poor pig farmer like me was allowed to go to school. I didn't think it was allowed. But she convinced me, you know, that it was, and she also grew up poor and paid her way, you know, worked her way through school, and suddenly it seemed possible. So, yeah, I would say that, I don't know if I would ever done some of the things I've done in life without her, but she certainly set me, you know, in the right direction. So yeah, she's something else. I just emailed her yesterday. We still talk and have lunch occasionally.
We have about 5 minutes left. I'm trying to decide which questions to ask. How did you become a teacher yourself?
Well, I was not really a teacher. I was director of a math school. That was in Milwaukee. I moved to Milwaukee, and it's really the only time I've ever used my degree. There was a math school. It was owned by a company from India. And so I took that job. I don't know what that is in the screen there. Can you see that? Or is that just on my
screen? No, that's a note to me.
Oh, let me know. We got a couple minutes. So,
sorry, guys. I was just going to let you know we got 2 minutes left.
On this stuff, and that's how that happened.
Okay. Well, I guess it's time to let you go, Neil. We've been talking to Neil Wooten, author of With the Devil's Help, A True Story of Poverty, Mental Illness, and Murder. It's been a great interview. Thanks a lot, Neil.
All right. Thank you.
Great. And now this.
Welcome to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM. My name is Molly Ray, and I am here with Wayne Johnston with his soon-to-be-available book/memoir called Jenny's Boy. Hello, Wayne. It's great to meet you.
Hi, Molly. Nice to meet you.
And then where are you calling in from?
I'm in what I call my bunker in Toronto right now. It's very quiet down here. So it's where I write, and where I actually, strangely enough, it's been where I've been sleeping for the past few days because they're doing construction on the road outside my house.
Mm.
So I haven't been able to sleep or write anywhere except down here in what I call the bunker.
Mm. That's interesting visuals. I kind of like that though.
Yeah.
Quietness is imaginable. So I guess we could start talking about, this is an autobiographical book, and it's one of a couple that you've done. Would you like to share some details or exciting things about the plot with us?
Yeah, it's a memoir. It's the story of my eighth year growing up in Newfoundland, the most easterly province of Canada, and I lived in the most easterly part of that province, so way out in the North Atlantic. I think everyone, when they're a child, thinks their childhood is exceptional. That notion is something that I still have, because I'm pretty sure that my childhood was exceptional. This book tells the story of one of the places that I lived in, and the story of how I kind of survived the year while living there. My family and I, we used to move almost 2 or 3 times a year for reasons that when I was 7, 8 years old, I didn't understand. We would just be settled into a house, and we'd come home from school and find a moving truck in the yard and realize that we were moving again, not having been told that morning that we would be moving. So we'd pile into this truck, and we'd only drive a couple of miles in the same town that I grew up in Newfoundland. And we'd move into a new house. And that's what happens at the beginning of this book. We move into a new house. And this is kind of where both my very early childhood and my family's history of moving kind of hits, I don't know if rock bottom exactly is right, but mm-hmm. it's a set of circumstances that are quite daunting that we have to overcome in the space of just several months. So that's a kind of pencil sketch of the book. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I'm going to bring that up again later with the amount of time that you squish into this book. When I'm looking at your other works and investigating them, there seem to be a lot of fiction and short stories, except for this one, and then your other memoir, The Baltimore's Mansion, which also takes place in the area of Newfoundland, right?
It does. It's a slightly different area. It does.
Okay. And I wanted to ask, is your writing process how is your writing process different between writing fiction and then writing nonfiction memoirs?
Well, as you said, I mainly write fiction. But when I'm writing fiction, for whatever reason, this is how I started out, I was still borrowing heavily from my own autobiography, And when I sort of started to run out of adult material, so to speak, for novels, I started to think about writing historical fiction, which has in common with autobiography a kind of ready-made template. You know, when you write about your childhood, you're writing about things that actually happened. You don't have to do research because it's all in your head, or hopefully it is. Mm-hmm. When you write historical fiction, again, you're writing about things that really happened, although if you're writing modern historical fiction, you are probably amending the history in some way. But again, you have that template, you have that blueprint already there. Mm-hmm. So that part of the method is the same. But when I'm writing nonfiction, which I've only done twice, what I find with both books is that it's kind of like going into a closet that's full of papers that haven't been sorted by an archivist. And somewhere in there is a story, if you can find it, and if you're patient enough to look for it. That's especially true with narrative nonfiction, you know, as opposed to sort of autobiographies that are kind of a series of name dropping, you know,
yeah.
This is who I met, this is who I had dinner with, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I did with Jenny's Boy. It was very intense. Most people, I think, don't have occasion to recall their past in great detail. Maybe if they're in therapy or something, they do. But even then, mm-hmm. childhoods are things that it takes quite a lot of investigating to get into. Photographs, for instance, that you appear in that you don't remember ever having been taken,
mm-hmm.
or you look nothing like you remember looking. No one else looks like you remember them looking. And so it's a journey back, and you take that journey, the same journey the reader takes, I took in writing the first draft, because everything, although it had happened, seemed fresh, because I couldn't remember some of those details I found in the photographs. So it was very intense, very emotional going through the first draft. And then the sort of more artful side of writing took over in the subsequent drafts. And I especially did want to write a narrative memoir rather than one that kind of gambled about, you know. In the subsequent drafts, it became similar to writing fiction.
Okay.
That's something we can get into if we have a chance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was gonna ask you, and you kind of went into it, like what that journey and process was like going into such an acute piece of your childhood and history. And then everything is very fast. You know, it's only like a year or two from, I think
it's actually 6 months.
6 months. Yeah. Because it went so fast, and it was so much content, and it was only 6 months of your life.
Yeah. I was lucky with, I don't even know who preserved all the photographs that I used for inspiration and for detail. You know, it's mm-hmm. not often you can say with your hand on your heart that when you were 6 years old, you wore a certain kind of shirt, you know. But I can, because the, you know, even on the cover, there's a photograph of me that I don't remember having been taken.
Mm-hmm.
So parading through all those photographs, not just of me, but of my four brothers, of my parents as they were back then, looking
mm-hmm.
so young, much younger than I am now. It was, as I said, a very sort of emotionally intense, often very, very funny. I remembered comic things from a childhood that at the time didn't always seem comic, but in retrospect, you have a better context to see them in, and especially certain characters. I don't want to sort of steal a march on your questions, but you know, certain characters like my grandmother, Lucy, mm-hmm. Who in this book lives just across the road from our house. She basically, you know, in that eighth year of my life, kind of saved my life, I think. That's how I look at it. But I had no idea at that time that anything like that was going on. But she was one of the funniest people that I remember meeting ever in my life. And I know about her in the kind of detail that I write about, because so many other people that I knew growing up after she was gone had known her and had anecdotes to tell about her, and anecdotes to tell that it had occurred between her and me that I didn't remember. And so, you know, I called on family memory as my own to write the book.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty fascinating too, because, you know, we really do kind of choose what we experience and see to an extent, and we're completely out of control, out of anything else. And so history that's kind of happening around you that you don't even register, going back to that and processing that. Like, yeah, my family took a lot of pictures too. And I think I'll randomly get texts with pictures that I've never seen before when they're digging through a box that I'm like, at work, and all of a sudden I'm just like, oh, my heart, of like a surprise and emotion that can just blow through you from a picture is so real. And so studying deeply, that's a lot of energy, I can only imagine. And so in saying that, there's so much in this 6 months of this book. Is there more that you think you need to tell? Do you want to tell more from after that period, or more from before that period?
You know, I think over the past few years, I've started to realize that I won't be able to write every book I want to write. You know, sooner or later, everyone runs out of time. And I think of the books that someone once said to me recently, actually, or I asked them, you know, it was another writer. I said, are you working on a book? And she said, no, I don't have an idea for a novel now. Mm-hmm. And it just struck me that I have never been without an idea for a novel. And you know, anyone who's ever watched airplanes land at an airport, you can, you know, if it's a major airport, you can see them all stacked up, the lights coming toward the airport. They're all of different sizes. So the, you know, the ones closest are biggest, and then you go back and you see this little pinprick of a light that's like a star, and that's coming. And that's how I see all the books I want to write. You know, they're all coming into land, but I don't know when one is going to appear in the sky that will actually never get there, you know?
Hopefully you never crash.
I hope they don't crash land.
well, that's amazing. And I'm sure that can be very almost overwhelming to have that foresight of wanting to get all of that done. So I'm glad that you have the ambition that you do, because there's also people that have all those ideas and, you know, they never get to it, even though they want to so bad. You know, I've definitely been guilty of that.
I was told years ago, you know, if you want to be a writer, write your books. Don't talk about them until they're finished. Because talk about them, you might talk them out, and the inspiration for them might diminish or go away entirely. So I followed that advice. You know, knowing ahead of time that you have books you want to write takes a lot of pressure off. Because writers are always wondering, what do I do next? And their readers want to know what's coming next, you know? So it's a great thing to get you out of bed in the morning, you know? There's no languishing when it comes to, at least in my sort of view of writing.
That's good. Let's see. I want to talk, obviously, I told you I have a cat. The cat is so cute because it's almost a little, it's so sweet how you have this relationship, this like distant relationship with this little cat named Murchie. Is that how you say that? Mm-hmm. Murchie, that lives with your grandma Lucy. And it's like this little friend, but you never really get to interact with it that much. But the cat kind of followed the timeline of the book to the end. And you put that in there so deliberately. Do you want to talk about that? Just because, you know.
Yeah. Murchie was what I think of as my first pet. Because we couldn't literally afford a pet. And I don't think my parents especially wanted, one more responsibility, given that they had four boys in quick succession.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went across the road, you know, I was so sick I couldn't go to school, and I would my mom used to teach me at night, and then by day I would go across the road to my grandmother Lucy's house, and she had what had been a barn cat, but now domesticated. So it was a huge cat. I don't know what kind, but you know, imagine something the size of a Maine Coon cat, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, for me, I think of him as kind of, you know, the proto cat. He was, you know, the first cat. Mm-hmm. And in the book, and I had no idea that this would be the case when I started out, but in the book, what I came to realize was that Murchie kind of links my grandparents. They were very sort of, you know, in the old-fashioned rural tradition of, you know, the woman taking care of the house, and the money and everything else, and the man, in this case, Ned, my grandfather, taking care of his farm. They were both so, you know, exhausted most of the time that Ned especially almost never spoke. He literally almost never spoke to me. So the Murchie would make an appearance during the day from time to time when Ned was having lunch. Mm-hmm. And he would always look as though he was about to pounce on my grandfather, which would not have been a good idea for either one of them. He keeps going in the book like that. And I realized that it was something, one of the rare things they shared, that they didn't talk about him that much. Ned didn't talk about him at all. But by the time you get to the book, the end of the book, Murchie has achieved a kind of status in Ned's life that, mm-hmm. was real, it actually happened, but that I don't think anyone could have foreseen. And I don't want to give I don't want to give the ending away.
Yeah.
But you know, he plays a big part in it.
You know? Yeah, I know that was very surprising. You know, I think that was like a very good and lovely treat at the end, where I was just like, oh. So then I do think we would have time. We have like, I don't know, 8 minutes. Do you want to read a little chunk? Like,
yeah. Sure, I can read a little bit. This is a section where I go across the road to Lucy's house. It's the first time I've seen her in quite a while.
Okay.
She's been sick and I haven't seen her, and I've been sick and therefore she hasn't seen me. So I arrive at the house, and this is how it goes. I arrive, by the way, with what's called my bedmobile, which I would carry around, push around with me from place to place because often I didn't have enough energy to stand. So she says to me as I come in the house, "There he is with his contraption," she said. "You're like the sick in the Bible who carry their pallets around with them." She got up and crossed the kitchen floor, put her hands on my shoulders and looked down at me. "Do I look like I've been sick?" she said. She didn't, so I shook my head. "You look like you are sick," she said. "Mind you, if you didn't, I'd think there was something wrong with you." Lucy's eyes were as dark as burnt raisins. Her eyebrows were almost as dark, but her hair was white and had been since she was 40, mid-length and curled under at the sides. We began the day as we had each day I had ever spent at her house, with her making me a glass of quick. I had some, and then she shouted, "Stop," after I'd had about three gulps. She took the glass from me, put it in the fridge, and put a saucer on top. "There must be something very special in quick if someone as picky as you can stomach it," she said. "Still, at that wedding feast in the Bible, where Christ changes the water into wine when they run out, he wouldn't have made much of an impression if he'd gone round spooning quick into everybody's glass, even though it would have been a miracle because there was no quick back then. A miracle per se is not enough. It has to be something good. If all he'd known how to perform were miracles that made things worse, he would have been hard put to find 12 apostles for the Last Supper." "Oh, that's a sin for me," she said, and crossed herself.
Yeah.
That's kind of a little snapshot of Lucy, her irreverence. She was very Catholic, but she didn't go to church. She kind of said a kind of liturgy for herself and was kind of a satirist of Catholicism, which I kind of, in some ways, turned out to be myself.
Mm-hmm. And it gives a good example of like this eerie atmosphere of blasé about the illness that was very present with you and also like present within the family at certain times. And it's just like, it became humor at a certain point, and you're 8 years old and there's this sense of humor being thrown around about this. And I can't imagine that's pretty intense, even though it's so delicate in the conversations that come through.
Yeah, you know, we didn't have a lot, but like a lot of other people who don't have a lot, we had our sense of humor, we had our wit. I mean, you know, if you're poor, you always have whatever you were born with. Mm-hmm. And we were all born with the gift of gab, and we were all born with a sense of irony, a sense of humor. And it could get quite, although intense, quite hilarious at the dinner table when we all, you know, we were kind of making fun of the terms of our existence as a way of coping, I guess, and as a way of getting on each other's nerves, and you know, like any family, but intensely so with us. And even today, one of my brothers is deceased, but even today, when we all get together, if there are other guests around, they are sort of overwhelmed into silence as we sort of, you know, kibitz back and forth, you know. it's just the way we are.
Yeah, I love that. I'm hopeful that I do get some of that in my family settings, and I'm grateful for the bits of that I have. I'm gonna ask the last question here, and so this book is coming out in next month, but would you please give us some more details about how listeners can learn more about your book and then at the same time prepare to get themselves a copy if they want to do so?
Yeah, if they want to learn more about the book, they're, you know, in advance, the best thing they can do is go to my website. So that's Wayne Johnston, make sure of the T. So waynejohnston.ca. And you can find out there all of the books I've written, places you can get them. You'll find out the exact pub date, publication date of Jenny's Boy. You'll find out what Audible and ebook editions they're in, and you'll readers will be able to find them in, you know, as the saying goes, you know, wherever fine books are sold, which in this day and age is on Amazon, but also, you know, at bigger stores, chain stores like Barnes and Noble, and also at independent bookstores. I would say probably especially at independent bookstores in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely have a lot in Minneapolis. So January, and you said, is it the 23rd?
Yeah.
Okay, so
February.
Post-February 23rd, that's when they can be ready for that. Well, that's really exciting. You know, that was, I read the book a little while ago, and so I'm glad that it was, you know, it stayed fresh in the mind, and it was really lovely, incredibly lovely talking to you about it. And
I'm talking to you.
Thanks. I'll probably have to dig out and find some more works of yours. With that, I guess I'm going to close this down. And so I wanted to thank everybody for listening to Write On Radio with Wayne Johnston and I about his upcoming book, Jenny's Boy. If there's anything else you wanted to say for a second, welcome to.
Just that, although it's a memoir, it is a sort of narrative-driven memoir. It's kind of an idea that I'm driving home. Mm-hmm. I think among memoirs, it's kind of rare to have one that narrative-driven. And it's not because I forced it that way. It happened that 1 year had that shape naturally. And so I guess I was just lucky.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, thank you. And once again, this is Write On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM. And next is this.
Listening to Write On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Sam. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Neil Wooten and Wayne Johnston, and all of our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Write On Radio at kfai.org/writeonradio. You can listen to all of your favorite Write On Radio episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere you stream your podcasts. Please stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.